This is the 2019 Chicago mayoral debate.
To believe only 8 days left to make an important decision that will help shape this city for the next 4 years and beyond. Welcome to the 2019 Chicago mayoral debate. For the next hour, we will hear from the two finalists as they strive for victory in this historic election. Good evening. I'm Micah Mater.
And I'm Timon Bradley. Good evening. We hope to have a frank and thoughtful discussion of the biggest issues in the city of Chicago and how the candidates will tackle them as they move into the fifth floor at City Hall. With that, we say good evening to Tony Preckwinkle and Lori Lightfoot. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good evening.
For the next 60 minutes, commercial free, we're going to have a debate.
Yep, we're going to begin with your opening statements in just a moment. But first, a few housekeeping notes, folks. The studio audience has been asked to remain silent, refrain from outbursts, and when we start posing questions, each candidate will have 1 minute to answer with opportunities for 30-second rebuttals as well. We have provided you with a countdown clock, and we'll hold you to it, ladies, politely as possible, of course.
So let's get to it. You'll each have 2 minutes for your opening statement, and we will go alphabetically, so we will begin with you, Ms. Lightfoot.
Good evening, everyone. It's my great pleasure to be here. We have 8 days before one of the most historic choices that voters are going to have as to who the next mayor is going to be and what the future is going to hold and what our respective visions are for the city. I think that it's important for us to be talking about things like about how we're going to come up with solutions to some of our most challenging issues. First of all, we have to deal with the violence. We need to make sure that public safety is available in every neighborhood and not merely a commodity for the rich. We need to make sure that we are dealing with the lack of resources in our neighborhood schools so that they are quality schools and that every kid has an opportunity for a good education and that educational opportunity isn't determined by zip code. We need to make sure that we are addressing the issues that are most on the minds of Chicago voters. And I think we also need to keep in mind that our children are watching. I've had young people of various ages talk to me about what are our plans to make sure that Chicago is a city that is truly welcoming for them, that provides opportunity in every neighborhood. And I think that that's a fair question that both of us need to be focused on. How do we make sure that our young people have real opportunity, that they have affordable housing, that they have good paying jobs, not just $15 an hour jobs, but jobs in which they can build a future in their family? Those are, I think, some of the most pressing issues that the voters want to hear from us on, and I'm prepared to do that. We need to make sure that we're talking about the changes that are necessary and the way that city government performs for people all over the city. We need to make sure that we have a transparent government, a government that stands for integrity, and a leadership that leads from a point of equity and inclusion. I think those are the critical issues that voters want to hear from us about. I look forward to this conversation and continuing this conversation from now until April 2nd.
Thank you, Ms. Lightfoot. Ms. Preckwinkle.
Thank you very much, and good evening, everyone. You know, I love my city, and I know it faces tremendous challenges, but I've dealt with tough challenges before. And I want to talk a little bit about, you know, my story. Usually I'm a policy wonk, and I talk a lot about policy. But let me tell you a little bit about my early experiences. There were two black families in my elementary school. And the result was that my brother and I spent a lot of time fighting our way home from school. That is until we got to fourth grade and we were as big as the sixth graders. And one of the things I learned was that bullies don't want fights, they want massacres. And when you can give them a fight, they're not interested. I also learned that you have to stand up for yourself and the people you love. I learned in those difficult experiences to be a fighter. I won as alderman on my third try, beating the machine. And I had the privilege and honor of serving the people of the fourth ward. I worked with community residents to improve our public schools, to develop our communities, to build affordable housing, to build shopping centers and serve our small and medium-sized businesses. And I also worked with commanders and police officers and community residents to address the public safety challenges that our communities face. Those are social justice issues, and social justice motivates me in my entire public career. As county board president, I worked to bring health care to 320,000 people who never had it before. I worked to bring reform to our criminal justice system, which disproportionately impacts black and brown young men. And we worked hard to be sure that those accused of violent crimes did not spend the time between their arrest and the disposition of their cases in our jail. You shouldn't stay in jail simply because you can't pay your bond. I've been motivated my entire public life by a concern for social justice, and I'll bring that into the mayor's office.
Ms. Brackwinkle, thank you very much. Let's stick with you and begin. Over the weekend, Susana Mendoza endorsed Lori Lightfoot, becoming the seventh former mayoral candidate to do so. None of your former opponents from the February election have endorsed you. What does that say about the relationships you've built during this campaign? 1 minute.
You know, the endorsements that really count are the endorsements of the voters on Election Day. And I've been very encouraged. We had 1,500 people at a rally this weekend. I've been to churches and well-received in a number of community events. And our volunteers and staff are talking to voters around the city to hear their concerns and to hear our proposals for addressing the challenges the city faces. And that work is really important. It's critical that you touch base with your constituents as you try to move forward. I think it's really important that we're doing this groundwork to touch base with our constituents, and I look forward to a positive outcome in April. You know, this is really an important election, and I know that reaching out and talking personally with the people of the city of Chicago will make all the difference in that election.
Well, Ms. Lightfoot, your former opponents, the people who were running for mayor, many of them are noted politicians, experts in business. None of them are backing you. They got to know you before and after the debates. They've researched your positions. They've known you for a long time, and they're backing Ms. Lightfoot.
The endorsements that matter are those of the voters on April 2nd.
Ms. Lightfoot, 30-second rebuttal.
Well, what I feel grateful for is people talking about the real possibility for change in this election. What I've been hearing from voters all over the city, in every neighborhood that I've been to, is that they want to change, but they didn't think that it was truly possible. I think what people understand is that the status quo has failed them. People tied to the broken and corrupt political machine have really choked off innovation and ideas and had a stranglehold on all aspects of Chicago life. I think people are energized by the possibility of breaking from that past.
Thank you. Micah?
Ms. Lightfoot, you've received campaign contributions from several of Mayor Emanuel's supporters, including one check for $100,000 from investor and philanthropist Paul Finnegan. You've also been criticized for accepting so-called dark money, for which Ms. Preckwinkle has criticized you. How does that fit in with the image that change that you've portrayed during this campaign?
Well, let me talk about this so-called dark money issue. Please. What we're talking about is organizations that are issue advocacy organizations that are organized by the rules and regulations of the Internal Revenue Service. There's nothing mystical about them. And in fact, President Preckwinkle has actually given money to so-called dark money issue advocacy groups. It's a real red herring. But the thing that I know is who I am, the values that I stand for, doesn't change with the people who give me money. And so I'm grateful for the 5,000 plus small donors that have given us donations since February 26. And we are building a real grassroots coalition around people that are giving $5 and $10. And yes, of course, there have been some bigger gifts, but I'm motivated by making sure that we bring real change and opportunity to the city and break from the past. The status quo has failed people, and I think people recognize that and are rallying to the mission for change.
Am I hearing you correctly? You would take money from anyone who would be willing to give you money for
your
campaign?
No, of course I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that this notion of who my donors are. For example, she's criticized me for taking donations from members of my former law firm. And the truth is, she's taken multiple donations. And if you look at the arc of President Preckwinkle's career, she's taken over $215,000 from law firms like Mayor Brown and Sidley, Jenner and Block, Jones Day. So that's all a red herring. What voters want to know about is what's our plans for the future? How are we going to create real opportunity and address the issues that are the meat and potatoes issues that people are worried about? Good jobs, crime, good schools, making sure that we have affordable housing. That's the thing that we should be focused on.
Your rebuttal, Ms. Preckwinkle?
Well, I'm very proud of the support that I've gotten from the labor union movement in the city of Chicago. I know how important it is to be supported by working families because I've worked hard to protect the interests of working families my entire public life. And let me just say, you know, $40,000 in dark money. Where does dark money come from? The most conservative, reactionary parts of the political spectrum. That's where it's come from historically, not just in this state, but in this country. So it's very troubling that Lori Lightfoot, who describes herself as an outsider, would take dark money, which is the epitome of inside politics.
All right. Ms. Frankwinkel, do you support statements made by your supporters this weekend that the blood of the next young black man or black woman who is killed by police would be on the hands of voters who support Ms. Lightfoot?
You know, Congressman Rush speaks for himself. He's been a civil rights activist his entire life. And the concerns that he raised about police misconduct and the treatment of black and brown people in our criminal justice system are valid concerns. And to suggest that it's divisive to bring up those concerns, marginalize them, and demeans them, and they're critically important issues. I've spent my last 8 years working very hard on criminal justice reform, ensuring that people who are accused of nonviolent crimes do not spend weeks or months in jail simply because they can't afford a cash bond. And that criminal justice work has a tremendous impact on black and brown communities. Because as I usually say, our criminal justice system, our jails, are at the intersection of race and poverty. And these are critical issues that we need to address, not just here in Chicago, but in our county and in our country. And I have spoken up about the need to address the disproportionate impact of our criminal justice system on black and brown communities since I took this job.
Ms. Lightfoot.
Well, I think it's interesting that President Preckwinkle is essentially saying that voters who support me somehow are going to have blood on their hands. There are 91,000 people that supported me in February. I expect a similar or larger number this next time around. It's surprising to me that she would say that somehow they're essentially murderers for supporting me and not her. But let me read you a quote from somebody who had commented previously on my work. I've been briefed on the task force findings and recommendations, and I want to commend Lori Lightfoot and members of the task force on their work and their honesty. That was a quote from President Preckwinkle on April 15, 2016.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lightfoot. We're going to stay with you and let's actually talk about the Police Accountability Task Force, which you chaired. It, of course, put out a blistering report about the Chicago Police Department. The report said in part, and we're going to put it on the screen for you to take a look at, the report said many people said some Chicago police officers are racist and approach every encounter with people of color as if they are a criminal. So, Ms. Lightfoot, if elected, how will you earn the respect of rank-and-file officers, some of whom you've called racist? 1 minute.
Well, we didn't call them racist. And the quote that you said, that you put up there, were we reflecting the voices of people that we heard in a lot of different forums, public forums, one-on-one conversations, and group conversations. And you got to read the report, obviously, in context. But there again, President Preckwinkle praised the work of me and my task force members on April 15, 2016, in a statement that's still up on the county's website. Let me just finish the quote. I've been briefed on the task force's findings and recommendations, and I want to commend Lori Lightfoot and members of the task force on their work and their honesty in bringing long-needed official focus to these issues. This report serves as a critical voice for thousands of residents and entire communities. And if you look at the entirety of the task force report, what we recommended were a series of things that were intended to strengthen police officers, like better training, making sure that they had real-life simulation, making sure that there were wellness programs in place. Officers know that, which is why they're supporting them.
So yes or no, is the department racist?
I think that people have a perception that the quality of policing that they get is determined by their race, and we can't ignore that perception of people in the community.
Ms. Preckwinkle, we just heard a quote there. You were praising Lori Lightfoot's work on the Police Accountability Task Force.
You know, we have some real challenges in our police department, and I've talked about several of them. The first is that we need to acknowledge that there's a code of silence in the police department. And unless we acknowledge it, we can't possibly address it. And secondly, we have to acknowledge that there's racism in the police department, as there is in all sectors of our economy and all professions. We have to acknowledge that, and we can't address problems that we won't acknowledge. And that's one of the reasons why I've said that there will be a transition and Superintendent Johnson will depart. You know, I think it's really important that the superintendent acknowledge the challenges that are being faced by the department, and surely the code of silence and racism within the department are two parts of that. And let me just say, many of our black and brown communities are wary of the police and won't cooperate with them because of their interactions with the police that are often based on race. And it's really important, if we're going to solve crimes in our community, that there be collaboration and cooperation between communities and police, and that has to be based on trust, and that trust has to be based on decent treatment of our citizens.
Thank you very much. Ms. Lightfoot, back to you. Of course, in that report, you were critical of police, but on the other hand, people say you've given the cops a break. In June 2000, 17-year-old Robert Washington was shot and killed by a Chicago police officer during an attempted carjacking. The Office of Professional Standards ruled the shooting unjustified, but you overturned the ruling. You said there was nothing you could do because the police superintendent rejected the finding. Would you advocate for harsher punishments for police officers, and what specifically would that look like?
Well, your recitation of the facts is just not correct. So let me make sure that we get the facts right, and then I'm happy to respond to your question. The shooting happened in June of 2000, 2 years before I even got to the police department. This case was thoroughly investigated. OPS at the time, under different leadership, recommended that the officer involved, Phyllis Cleanscales, be terminated. The superintendent rejected that, and that rejection was backed up, as I understand it, by the Corporation Council. By the time this case got back to me, the command channel review, that means supervisors of the officer, were recommending that no punishment be done. So by the time it got to me, there was a 30-day recommendation on the table, and I upheld that recommendation to fight to make sure that there was some discipline against the officer. So getting those facts right, I think, is critically important. A case that had a life and was investigated 2 years before I even got to the police department and had been back and forth between the superintendent's office and OPS, I think it's important that we make sure we get the facts right.
Ms. Preckwinkle, 30 seconds.
Sure. You know, many of our officers are good and decent people who struggle every day to do a very difficult job well, and we need to acknowledge that. But we also need to acknowledge that there's some real challenges in the police department. And one of those challenges, of course, is the code of silence. And the other is that often officers who engage in bad conduct are not appropriately disciplined. And let me just say, Lori Lightfoot was appointed several times by Mayor Emanuel to positions overseeing the police department and did not, in my view, adequately account for the bad acts of those officers.
All right. We're out of time. Save that thought. Ms. Preckwinkle, finish your statement quickly.
You know, look, it's important to understand that Lori Lightfoot, at the same time that she received appointments from Rahm Emanuel to various police accountability positions, was also defending police for misconduct and being paid by the city to do so. I think that's important to remember.
Got it. And Ms. Lightfoot, 30 seconds. Yes, please.
First of all, again, President Preckwinkle misstates blatantly the record. Number one, when I was police board president and started, police board was holding officers accountable only 35% of the time. Over the arc of my tenure as police board president, we reversed that, and we held police officers accountable 73% of the time, and it would have been higher. And also, as President Preckwinkle knows, I took no private cases related to the police department when I was serving in those appointed positions, so that's just false.
Okay. Let's advance this conversation. Michael?
This next question is for the both of you. In September of 2016, I traveled to Detroit to interview the police chief, James Craig. That city's homicide rate has decreased for two straight years with some of the lowest homicide numbers in nearly five decades. Chief Craig believes Chicago is fixable as well. His answer is not to hire new police officers, but to clean house and work with the officers we already have. So my question is Chicago fixable? How do you plan to fix it immediately? And specifics, please. President Preckwinkle.
Thank you very much. I believe that it's really important that we address the challenges in our police department. You know, early in my teaching career, I lost a student to gun violence, and I know how impactful, how devastating that is to the communities that face that violence. Everyone has the right to feel safe in their home and in their community, and the first priority of the mayor has to ensure that people are safe in their homes, and that involves better cooperation between police and the community, because that's the only way in which you can really solve crimes. We've invested a lot in technology, we've invested a lot in cameras and shot spotters, but the real way to address those challenges is through better police community relations. We have to invest in community policing. We have to invest in better training and supervision of our police officers. And we have to invest in holding our police officers accountable for actually solving crimes. But we can't do this with police officers alone. We have to invest in community-based organizations that do the difficult work of violence prevention, anti-recidivism, and restorative justice work makes it possible for our communities to be safe.
Thank you. Ms. Lightfoot, you have a minute.
Oh, I actually know Chief Craig from Detroit. Mm-hmm. Spent a lot of time talking with him as we were doing the work of the Police Accountability Task Force, which President Prankwinkle praised me for before she decided she was going to run for mayor. CPD, of course, is fixable. It has to be fixable because literally lives depend upon it. We have the roadmap and the tools that we need. It starts with the Police Accountability Task Force. We laid out a series of recommendations and findings, sadly, most of which have not been picked up. But that is the underpinnings for the Department of Justice Obama report that now many of those proposals are embodied in the consent decree. But we've got to go beyond the consent decree, and I've offered a very specific detailed suggestions on how we can do that. But fundamentally, we have to make sure that our police department is well-trained, well-resourced, and that officers understand that respectful and constitutional engagement with the communities that they are sworn to serve and protect is their most important tool. And of course, we need to bridge that divide by taking those steps.
Thank you.
We've reached out to experts in various fields across Chicago. Some of them you're going to recognize for their thoughts about the future of our city. And we turn now to a question from Lawrence Massall of the Civic Federation on the city's financial situation.
In spite of Mayor Emanuel and the City Council's efforts to raise property taxes, 911 fees, and water fees just to stabilize the city pensions, the city, under state law, still faces a $1 billion required increase in contributions to the city pension funds during your first term. Where will you, as mayor, turn for that $1 billion? Will it be cuts in existing programs that don't abandon your commitment to increasing funding for public safety and education? Or will it be in some other form of tax increases?
Ms. Lightfoot, 1 minute.
Well, I have a great deal of respect for Lawrence Massall and have consulted him along the way. I don't agree with all the things that the Civic Federation is recommending, but clearly we're going to have a conversation about progressive revenue sources. But before we get there, given that people feel like they're taxed to death, and particularly with regressive taxes like the ticketing and red light cameras, we have to build the case for revenue. I think we start by doing this. We start by looking at the ways in which we're squandering precious tax dollars. We just saw a report in the last 2 weeks that in 2018, we spent $113 million on police settlements, judgments, and attorney's fees alone, 28 of which went to defense costs. People don't believe that we are doing what's necessary to cut costs, find savings. There are things that we can do, like look at, do we need a treasurer's office? Do we need a clerk's office? Should we be consolidating the county board of elections with the city board of elections? And we have to look at the redundancy in our pension funds that have separate administrative and investment of functions.
You want some savings and cuts, it sounds like, but the city's four pensions are short $28 billion in next year's budget. You have to come up with $276 million for pensions. Where is that money going to come from?
The money is going to come from building the case for revenue by demonstrating to taxpayers that we're not treating them like an ATM machine with no limit. We can't ask people to dig into their pockets further until we can demonstrate that we are being better fiscal stewards of their tax dollars. We also need to make sure that we have a risk management function in the city. This is a $9.5 billion city budget. We have no risk management function, meaning there's nobody who spends every single day looking at ways in which we can save money, mitigate waste, so that we can then use those resources to address the structural deficit and the pension obligation that we're going to have in 2020.
All right, Ms. Preckwinkle.
Thank you. You know, we have to look at this through an equity lens. And I always begin by talking about the need for a progressive income tax at the state level, not just to meet the state's fiscal challenges, but because the state shares revenue with local units of government, cities, towns, and villages. We want to be sure that that revenue is raised as equitably as possible. And coming to the city itself, it's going to have to be shared sacrifice. We're not going to have any magic solutions, an old silver bullet. It's going to be shared sacrifice. I always begin by talking about our TIF programs, Tax Increment Financing Districts. districts, which now take 31% of our property tax revenues. We have to unwind some of those TIFs, eliminate them, and also declare surpluses in our TIFs so that we can use those resources to meet our other obligations and responsibilities. We need to do things like change our workman's comp policy. The county has 22,000 employees. We spend just $20 million on workman's comp. The city has 35,000 employees, and they spend five times that much, $100 million on workers' comp.
Let me follow with you as well, because we really would like to get specifics. The city is facing $252 million budget deficit. If you win, you'll have to present your budget this fall. How do you close the gap? Where does the money come from?
Well, let me tell you what happened when I came into office in 2010. We had a $487 million gap to close. $487 million. And I brought the 11 separately elected county officials together, and I said, each of you is going to have to cut your budget 15%. And believe me, there was a lot of squealing. However, that's what we did. We also refinanced some of our debt, and in one of the most difficult decisions of my political life, we laid off 1,500 people. We made the tough decisions that we had to make to balance the budget, and we can do that again. Over the last 9 years, we've balanced our budget every year. We've closed budget gaps of $2.1 billion. We've made $850 million in cuts. We've reduced our workforce by 13% and our indebtedness by 11% and improved the services that we deliver to county residents. So I have experience making the tough decisions that need to be made to balance the budget and delivering good services nonetheless. That's the challenge.
Micah, do you want to try?
let's keep talking taxes. Ms. Lightfoot, you've repeatedly said you want to have a conversation about revenue before raising taxes. To whom specifically would you have that conversation with? Give us an outline.
Well, first of all, as I said, I think we've got to go through a process of demonstrating to taxpayers, because those are the ones that are going to be on the line, that we're taking their fiscal concerns seriously. We can't keep balancing the budget, for example, on the backs of low-income and working-class people who are least able to afford it. We've taken, in the last 7 years, the city of Chicago has taken, for example, 50,000 cars from people because of tickets. We have seen study after study that shows that the ticketing process is disproportionately affecting people of color. We see that tickets for bike riding are being levied against black folks in neighborhoods more than they are anybody else. So people don't feel like the government is responsive and working for them. They feel like the government is oppressive. We're going to have a serious question about revenue, but we can't do it when people don't feel like the government has any integrity or legitimacy when it comes to financial matters.
But when you say having that conversation, you say you want to talk to constituents, but is there an expert or someone you think can help you on this?
Well, of course. I mean, if I'm elected mayor, we're going to have a fully fledged financial team that absolutely is going to help us with it. There's been a lot of studies and a lot of ideas out there, but as I said before, and I stand by this, we can't just say to people, here's the size of government, we need your money to help fund it. We've got to demonstrate to people that we are looking seriously at ways in which we can cut the cost of government, waste and inefficiency, and redundancies. I think when we do that, we're going to be better positioned to have that conversation.
Ms. Perkwinkle, we want you to weigh in, but let me set it up. We know your history with taxes, reinstating the Todd Stroger sales tax that you campaigned against, implementing the infamous soda tax. How do you assure voters you won't nickel and dime Chicagoans?
Well, let me just say, if you want good government, you have to pay for it. But the first case you have to make is that you're effective and efficient. And as I said, when we faced a $487 million gap in our budget, the first thing I did was go to the 11 separately elected officials and tell them they had to cut their budgets 15%. That was where we started, with cuts in operations. And we tried to do that with as little impact on program and services as we possibly could. But let me just say, in the city of Chicago, we have disproportionately impacted communities of color, particularly poor communities of color, with tickets, fines, and fees, whether it's for bike riding or marijuana possession or parking, vehicle tickets. You know, Mother Jones did a study, and it showed that in the city of Chicago, 8 of the 10 communities that had the most tickets were African-American communities. So the disproportionate impact of our criminal justice system applies not simply to misdemeanors and to felonies, but also to the ticketing process that is inherent in the fundraising.
Your thoughts on that? Your rebuttal?
Well, I think she actually just repeated what I said in my previous answer. We can't balance the budget on the backs of people who are least able to afford it. That seems clear to me. I hear it from people all over the city. I can't tell you the number of people who have come to me and said, I had a $20 ticket and it doubled and doubled and doubled. I lost my car. I can't get to my job. Those are real issues and concerns of people across the city, and I think we have an obligation to address them.
All right. People, this is for both of you guys. People are outraged by property taxes. Mm-hmm. Some residents have complained they're opening up the mail to find a 50% increase. Well, you both agree property taxes are too high. You don't need to raise them again, as you say. But how will you avoid a property tax hike? And what relief would you offer to residents struggling, and I mean struggling, to pay these increased bills? Ms. Lightfoot?
Well, the first thing is I wouldn't support someone like Joe Berrios, who is the poster boy for bad government, presided over a broken and corrupt property tax assessment system that has crushed individual homeowners. Because of the underassessment of commercial properties, that tally has to be made up somewhere, and it's been made up on the backs of low-income, middle-income homeowners, which also affects rents, which are rising because of this underassessment. I think what we have to do first is make sure that we hold Fritz Kagi, who I have a great deal of respect for, true to his campaign promises to fix this system, and soon. I won't be silent like Mayor Rahm Emanuel was in the unfairness of this property tax system. I'm going to do everything I can, if I'm mayor, to make sure that we get it right-sized quickly. I'm a homeowner. I also got sticker shock when I got my assessment bill that went up way over 50%, seemingly without any basis in fact and untethered from reality.
All right. Mr. Breckwinkle, what are you going to do about these property taxes if you become mayor?
First of all, the county has not raised property taxes in the 9 years that I have been president of the county. And we haven't done that because the property tax system is inherently unfair. The burden falls disproportionately on residential property owners rather than commercial and industrial property owners. And that's why I've supported a progressive income tax at the state level, so that more revenue can be raised in a more equitable way, and we can reduce reliance at the local level on property taxes, because these are a real burden to our residents. And frankly, the changes in the property tax instrument are going to impact communities that have been undervalued in the past and hopefully benefit communities, particularly black and brown people, communities of color, that have been overassessed in the past. So I can understand why my opponent, who lives in a relatively prosperous part of the city, has gotten a tremendous increase in her property taxes. But it's making up for past inequities. And I think that that's what we need to do, and hopefully Assessor Kagi will continue to do that.
Okay, yes or no? You'll raise them, property taxes, or you won't raise them?
I think it's not...
Yes or no?
It doesn't make sense to make any commitments at this point.
We have to avoid it at all costs.
Okay.
Didn't get an answer there. Let's move to a question from another expert.
I think you did get an answer.
And I suspect you're going to recognize this person. Take a look.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's Miguel Cervantes here, your friendly neighborhood A.Ham, and I am not throwing away my shot to ask the candidates a question, so here it is. As we've been able to be here for the last few years in Hamilton, my family and I have fallen in love with this town, and we've seen how amazing the artistic community is here and how important it is to this city as far as tourism and being known as a city that attracts amazing artistic types to make this the culture of the city so great. So I want to know what you're going to do to keep it that way. How are you going to support the arts in the city to make sure that we keep attracting people to come here and make it amazing, as well as supporting the young folks in schools and the artistic programs and arts programs in schools to make sure that those young minds who are out there writing the next Hamilton are able to be supported in their next endeavors.
Ms. Breckwinkle, what do you think of Alexander Hamilton's question?
I'm a big fan, actually, of the musical. You know, I think it's important to understand that the arts enliven and enrich our lives, and we should do whatever we can to be supportive of the arts community. And that was surely what I did when I was alderman of the 4th Ward. Actually, we engaged young people in murals under our viaducts, the most dreary parts of our infrastructure. We engaged young people to do murals in those under those viaducts to brighten them and enliven them. So I really believe in the importance of arts and the critical role they play in the vitality of our city. I think it's important that we use our grants, our city grants, in a way that encourages not simply the bigger arts organizations, but the smaller ones as well. So we'll have to look carefully at the way in which we're allocating resources to the arts community to be sure that we're supporting community-based organizations and smaller arts groups as well as the larger ones. And I think it's important that we also support the arts in our schools, programs like After School Matters and Merit Music. The programs that bring arts programming into our schools need to be fully funded so that all of our children have the opportunity to take arts programming.
Thank you very much. 1 minute, Ms. Lightfoot.
Well, because the arts are so critically important to the vibrancy of our city, but also to the economy of our city, I rolled out an arts program policy with and support by artists like Amy Morton of Steppenwolf, Sarah Paresky, one of our most famous authors, and Joel Hall of the Joel Hall Dancers. The arts community is incredibly vibrant. Just in the downtown area alone, it generates about $2.2 billion every year in revenue. We need to make sure that we are supporting artists at all levels. I propose that we increase the amount of grants that come from the Department of Special Events, which right now is only about $1.7 million, which is hardly enough to make sure that we're having real impact. I think that we ought to have artists in residence in our schools and give our young artists an opportunity to have, in effect, a free studio, but then provide art support in our communities. There are a number of things that we also need to be doing, but the arts have to be front and center in our economic
policy. And you want to increase the hotel tax to pay for this?
No, what I said is I want to make sure that we dedicate a portion of the hotel tax to help fund the increased grants that are given by DCASE.
Thank you.
All right, ladies, let's talk about education. Rachel Powers is the Dean of Students at Noble Charter Schools, and she has a question for you.
At my public charter school, we're proving what's possible by sending 90% of graduates to college every year. As you think of becoming responsible for CPS, which includes 54,000 students in charter schools like mine, how will you continue to protect the right of families to choose the best public education for their children?
Ms. Lightfoot, 1 minute.
Well, I think the focus has to be on rebuilding our neighborhood schools. I propose a moratorium on expansion of charters because I think that what we've done is we drain resources that are necessary for open enrollment neighborhood schools. So that's where my focus is going to be. We've got to make sure that we are also building opportunities for early childhood education. We need to make sure that we are engaged with parents at the earliest possible stage of their children's life and provide support in our neighborhoods so that by the time a young person gets to kindergarten that there's no achievement gap. We can't say that now because there's not sufficient resources that are being focused on early childhood education. And obviously we also need to make sure that we're thinking about making sure that our policies are viewed through a race and ethnicity lens so that there's not a negative impact on those categories of our students and our residents. And I also support a fully elected school board as well.
And your daughter attends private school. Why did you not have the confidence in the public school system when she started?
It has nothing to do with confidence. It had everything to do with access. We thought, both my wife and I, are public school kids. We absolutely thought our daughter would go to public school. But when we tried to get her in to preschool as a three-year-old, we were essentially told no room at the end. There weren't enough spaces to be able to get her in because we're a family of means and the waiting list was literally years long. So by the time we then got her into a different kind of school, she was established. She has a group of network of friends. We have a community in that school. It didn't make sense for us at that point to move her.
Ms. Preckwinkle, Rachel Powers answered her question.
Well, first of all, I have to say that I believe in an elected school board because I think that parents and community residents have to have an input into our Chicago public schools. I also support a moratorium on charter schools and a moratorium on school closings. We have to invest in our neighborhood public schools, which, by the way, my grandchildren attend and my children attended. It's really important that we invest in neighborhood public schools. And right now, you can pretty much predict the performance level of schools on the basis of zip codes. The most privileged parts of our city have the highest performing schools. And the rest of the city is often challenged with under-resourced schools. We need to be sure that we focus on neighborhood public schools because their education is an escalator. And every child deserves access to a great public education. And our neighborhood public schools, in contrast to magnet schools, charter schools, selective enrollment schools, take all of our young people. And they need to be well-resourced, not just with good teachers, teachers, but also with social workers, bilingual support, psychologists, so that our young people can really have an opportunity to succeed.
In fairness, I did ask her a follow-up, so I'm going to ask you a quick follow-up to this. In an interview with the History Makers, you said that you did teach at public schools at one moment, but you decided not to again. Have you changed your mind?
It was at a point in which the Chicago public schools were really challenged. So I taught, frankly, in public schools, private schools, and parochial schools. As I said, my children and my grandchildren attended Chicago public schools.
All right. Thank you very much. Ms. Lightfoot, in 2004, four kids died in a fire on the West Side. At the time, you were the chief of staff and general counsel of OEMC, responsible for 911 operations. Right away, there were questions about whether 911 calls were mishandled. The parents of the children filed a lawsuit, and the judge ordered you to preserve all evidence related to 911 calls. You received a copy of the judge's order, put a post-it note on it, and gave it to a secretary. The judge said it was very troubling how you failed to preserve some of the evidence, calling you shockingly lax. In another instance, when you were a federal prosecutor, you were also reprimanded by a judge during an extradition matter. How many times have you been reprimanded by a judge, and how do you respond to the charge that you were cavalier with that post-it note on a court order?
There was nothing cavalier about the way that we handled it. I directed the people who preserved the tapes to make sure that they preserved them, and they failed to do that. And the people who were responsible were disciplined accordingly. Let me just talk about that fire. This is a fire where a number of different 911 calls came in. The firefighters responded within minutes of being dispatched. If my recollection is, they were actually just down the block from the house where many kids were left at night. It was a fire that broke out at midnight, and the firefighters performed heroically in trying to save those children. Subsequently, a lawsuit was brought, but we simultaneously, as the fire, instructed the individuals to save and preserve those tapes, and they failed to do it. There were a number of calls that came in. One of the calls that came in, the call taker thought that there was a prank call and hung up on the caller. So we took action and disciplined that person.
What happened to the evidence? There were 2,000 calls that were missing.
I don't recall that. I recall that there was some calls that were missing. Unfortunately, the way that the 911 system works is they preserve tapes for 30 days, and then they get written over given the volume of the calls. As I indicated, I specifically instructed that tape be preserved and instructed my assistant to give the judge's order, which was routine, to the people who handled the tapes. They failed to do that, and we took appropriate action.
Ms. Perquico, 30 seconds. Would you like to weigh in?
I think it's important to remember that in this 2004 fire, four young people died. Four young people died. It's profoundly disturbing to me. Four young people died. And here's what the judge said about Lori Lightfoot's conduct. The judge, Egan, characterized the attorney's performance as shockingly lax and cavalier, and said there was a reasonable argument that the city was deliberately hiding evidence from the plaintiffs, something that the judges have repeatedly accused city attorneys of doing in lawsuits over the years.
All right. Okay, thank you. Micah?
I think I'm entitled to a 30-second rebuttal under
your
rules.
Yes, 30 seconds.
The fact that the Preckwinkle camp pushed reporters to report on the story, I think, underscores the desperation of this campaign. It absolutely is tragic that those four young people lost their lives. The calls to dispatch the fire trucks went out immediately. There were a number of calls that came in. They were down the block. They got there as quickly as possible. I fundamentally disagree with the judge's characterization, because the practice that we had, which worked on every other occasion, was to instruct them to preserve those tapes.
Like a 30-second response.
Well, directed to her question, did you plant this? Did your campaign reach out to reporters and direct them to pursue this?
You know, look, we're all responsible for the choices that we make in our lives and for our conduct.
Did your campaign shop around this story?
This is information that became available to us, and we shared it. Yes, that's true. But it's an important part of the record. She's responsible for the choices that she's made and for the decisions that she's made. And in this case, she was basically reprimanded by a judge for withholding evidence. And this is what it says.
Okay.
Shockingly lax and cavalier, right. And there was a reasonable argument that the city was deliberately hiding evidence.
Got it. We said it three times. Micah?
All right. President Preckwinkle, you say you have given back a campaign contribution related to beleaguered Alderman Ed Burke. Ms. Lightfoot says you haven't. Your administration gave his son a $100,000 a year job. You maintain a close relationship with Joe Berrios, who faced questions of nepotism. You stood by him after reports found his assessment system favored the wealthy at the expense of the poor. You fired your chief of staff over allegations of sexual harassment. You fired your campaign manager over a Nazi Facebook post. You faced questions over how political documents wound up in your county vehicle after it was abandoned. With all of these allegations against you, how can Chicagoans trust your judgment?
You know, I've worked very hard in my public life to be a good public servant. And let me just say, the real challenge here is addressing corruption in government. And there can be no tolerance for corruption in government. You know, I think it's really important to understand that in a democracy, people have to have faith in their government. That's why I've devoted so much of my public life to it, because I know what good things government can do. And I think the critical issue in the city, in terms of elected officials, is not having outside employment. That's really the issue. We have to know that our elected officials are serving us, are serving our constituents, and not our clients. So that's the critical issue. And you have to understand that this is not something that you can do by fiat. It's something you have to go to the city council and get approval of. And I've had the experience as a local elected official, as an alderman, in building consensus and developing consensus so that you can get legislation passed. And I think that's a critical issue. This is an important challenge to city government, being sure that our elected officials serve their constituents and not their clients.
Ms. Lightfoot, 30 seconds.
Well, I have to say, the tenor of the last few questions is really disappointing. We need to be talking about the issues that are most on the minds of voters. We've got a lot of big challenges that we have to face as a city. The next mayor is going to be leaving, this mayor is going to be leaving office with a stack of unfinished business. All this back and forth and rolling around in the mud doesn't answer the questions on the minds of voters. So I'm just going to say I hope that we're actually going to get back to real substance and issues so that we can speak to the voters of this city.
You don't think the voters are interested in corruption?
Well, I think that what we're doing is this throwing back and forth, she said, he said, but we're not talking about what our vision for the city is. So, no, I don't think we're doing that with the last few questions that have been asked, and I think that's disappointing. People want to know, where are we going as a city? How are we going to address public safety? How are we going to address finances? How are we going to address the schools? But what you're doing is asking the little gotcha questions, frankly, to each of us that I think are doing a disservice to the people who are really starting to tune in and want to know, what is the next mayor going to do to address the things that matter most to me? So, yes, I would like to see us get back to the issues.
Let's move on to another issue. Yes, this is an issue. Yes, this is relevant. Yes, we're asking questions on behalf of the citizens of Chicago. I want to show you a photo, an iconic moment from the campaign. This is Ms. Lightfoot with State Representative Robert Martwick, who crashed her news conference. You all got into a shouting match. Martwick introduced a bill to change the Cook County assessor from an elected position to an appointed one. Ms. Preckwinkle, do you favor that position, changing the Cook County assessor position to an appointed one, taking that power to pick the assessor away from the voters? And also, did you send Robert Martwick to that event?
No, of course not. And I don't support the idea that this should be an appointed position. I think it's important to have this position be an elected one. And as I said, I worked with Assessor Berrios to address the challenges in the property and taxation system, and now I'm working with Assessor Kagi. And not only Assessor Kagi, but all of the actors in the property and taxation arena, not just him, but the three members of the Board of Review, the clerk, the treasurer, and the recorder. It's really critical that we get our property tax system right. And I think it's critical, too, that this position continue to be elected so that the voters can have an opportunity to impact this critical part of county government. Property and taxation is one of our critical functions, and it's important that the members of that property and taxation arena be elected officials.
Thank you. Ms. Lightfoot.
The question is?
Do you favor, it's a rebuttal, so do you favor moving the Cook County assessor to an appointed position where someone would pick that rather than the voters choosing?
Of course not. That was the point of the press conference. That was a blatant attempt to undercut Fritz Kagi's work to reform the broken and corrupt tax assessment system that was presided over by Joe Berrios. I made that very clear that day, and when Mr. Martwick decided to show up and he admitted that he actually was sent by somebody in the Preckwinkle campaign, campaign. We went toe-to-toe, no doubt about it, because I think that undercutting a duly elected, independent property tax assessor makes no sense. It works for the machine, but it doesn't work for the voters.
All right. We now have a question from Kathy Byrne, daughter of Chicago's first and then only female mayor, Jane Byrne. It's for both of you.
Chicago has dire financial problems, a horrific crime rate, and a lot of, unfortunately, very angry people. You both have successful, happy lives, loving families, fulfilling work. Why risk that? Why do you want to be mayor?
Ms. Preckwinkle?
As I said, I love our city, and I know that it faces tremendous challenges, and I think there are challenges that I am uniquely qualified to address. You know, I had to fight to become alderman of the 4th Ward. I won on my third try against the machine, and I had the privilege of serving my community for almost 20 years, working hard with community residents to improve our neighborhood public schools, working with parents and principals and community residents. And we revitalized many of the communities in the ward, working with developers, working with the Chicago Housing Authority, working with community residents. And finally, we worked with police commanders and officers and community residents to address the public safety challenges that plague so many of our communities. And that difficult work, improving our neighborhood public schools, revitalizing communities that are struggling, and addressing the public safety challenges are the same challenges that the next mayor of the city of Chicago will face. And I have confidence that I can address those challenges, given the difficult work that I've done to transform communities as alderman of the 4th Ward. It's hard work to make change.
Ms. Lightfoot.
Well, as a kid who grew up in a low-income, working-class family, the one thing that my parents were able to give me was create real opportunity for me to be able to have a ladder up. It started, of course, with education, but my parents really instilled in me the mantra that if I worked hard and I took advantage of the opportunities that were in front of me, that I could be successful, that I could be in any room and not my race, my gender, or our financial status was going to hold us back. When I look across the city and I see the many challenges of individuals who look like me growing up in families like mine, I know that we can do better as a city. I've been very fortunate in my life because of my parents' sacrifices, and I want to make sure that our kids have the same kind of opportunity everywhere. I don't want zip code to define anybody's destiny. I want to create the opportunity so our young people can take advantage of it, so our seniors feel safe, so that we have affordable housing opportunities, that we take care of public safety needs. That's why I want to bring change to our city.
Ms. Lightfoot, you won't like this question, I suspect. It's not necessarily a policy question, but it has been mentioned once or twice or maybe 5,000 times that if you win, you will be Chicago's first black woman mayor. What does it mean to you to be black, Ms. Lightfoot?
Well, everything in my life is about being black. I've been denied opportunities as a result of my race. I have been called every name in the book because of that. But for me, it's a source of pride. Because of the sacrifices that my parents made. Both of my parents were born in the segregated South. For them, race defined their entire existence. I think in this time, what we need to do is be thinking about not just the color of our skin, but what brings us together as a community. We are fortunate to live in a great city that has a tremendous amount of diversity. People from all over the world, 140 plus different languages are spoken in our city. I want to make sure that we are focused on what is our common interest as a community so that we can bring together in a unified way the talent that we have in every community to be able to solve problems. Yes, it's historic, and it will be historic, but I'm really focused on the historic opportunity to bring real, meaningful change and make government work for the people.
Ms. Preckwinkle, what does it mean to you to be black?
Well, you know, as I started this evening, I talked about my experiences in my elementary school and fighting my way home from school with my brother through crowds of young people calling us names. You know, I think I became a history teacher in part to understand why it was that white people hated us. And maybe I should have studied psychology rather than history. But I think it's really important to understand that African Americans in this country have had a very bitter and challenging history. We've been slaves longer than we have been free people. And I try not to forget that. And the wonderful opportunities that this country has provided to so many have often been denied to us through discrimination, through racism. And we have to address those challenges. I always talk about our criminal justice system being at the intersection of race and poverty, because I think it's important to remind people that we continue to be challenged by racism in this country, and that that's one of the challenges that it's really important for us to address. And elected officials ought to speak to those challenges.
Thank you.
Madam President, you are known to have a somewhat frosty relationship with Mayor Emanuel, even ordering the symbolic closing of the door between city and county sections of the fifth floor. If Ms. Lightfoot wins, you will remain president of the county board. What kind of a relationship will you two have?
You know, it's in the interest of the people of the county that the county board president and the mayor work together, and that will surely be the case. And let me just say, when Mayor Emanuel was elected, he and I got together and said there has to be more cooperation between the city and the county. We share a building, but little else. There was a task force that was put together, and we came up with several dozen ideas about how we could work together. One of those was, of course, our employment training initiatives, the Chicago Cook Workforce Partnership, but there were a variety of others. It's really important that the county and the city work together in the interests of both residents of the city and the residents of our suburbs. And actually, as county board president, one of the things that I've done is try to work with the surrounding seven counties as well, because Chicago is part of a regional economy, a critical part of a regional economy, and it's important that we boost that entire regional economy and not just focus solely on the city. The city is part of a regional economy, and we have to be sure that it's a vital, important part, but we shouldn't forget that it's part of that regional economy.
Ms. Lightfoot, what about you? Can't we all just get along?
I think that's important. You know, as I've been saying to people, there's been a lot of overcharge inflammatory language in the last few days. But what I tell myself and what I'm telling other people is our children are watching. I think it's really important, as I've said now many times tonight, that we focus on what brings us together, not what divides us. You know, things happen in a political campaign, but there are certain lines that shouldn't be crossed. And I worry about the message that's being sent to children by some of the really overcharged language that we've seen in the last couple days. For somebody supporting President Preckwinkle to say that voters who support me are going to have blood on their hands, that's unacceptable. And I would hope, and I'm hoping and I'm waiting, that President Preckwinkle will reject that language. But regardless of what the outcome is, I'm going to be a person who continues to love our city. I'm going to be a person who continues to do everything that I can to advance the causes of people whose voices need to be heard. And I certainly am going to do everything I can to uplift the quality of the debate and the quality of life in our city.
Ms. Lightfoot, some
response.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, look, Congressman Rush speaks for himself, but the concerns that he raised about unfair treatment of black and brown people in our criminal justice system and police misconduct are legitimate issues, and they're important issues that we need to address. These are challenges that are faced by our city and by our country, and it's important that we talk about them and acknowledge them and not sweep them under the rug. We have to address these challenges. The disproportionate impact of our criminal justice system on black and brown people has criminalized communities of color, particularly the war on drugs. And I think it's important that we acknowledge those disparities and work to address them.
All right. So you will not condemn what he said?
Congressman Rush speaks for himself.
Tell us about the moment, this is for both of you, in this campaign that meant the most to you, that you will carry with you as a memory for the rest of your lives. Start with you, Ms. Lightfoot.
Well, I think about particularly when I announced back in May of 18 when Rahm Emanuel was still running. I had a number of spontaneous messages from friends whose daughters were really excited and energized by my campaign. And that has been really a remarkable experience. I've met a number of people along the way, young people, seniors, other people who want to share their life's experience, their anger, their frustration. But the common thread among the people that I've met along this journey is the hope and optimism for change. People want change. They want a leader who stands for integrity, who isn't part of the broken status quo. And that has really been an incredible experience for me, to see how generous people are and opening up their lives to me as a candidate. No other opportunity would I have to really experience, I think, the greatness and the genuineness of people all over the city. And I'm certainly forever changed by that.
Okay. Ms. Breckwinkle?
Well, I think it's two things. You know, first, everywhere I go in the city, I find people who really love their neighborhoods, who really care about them, and are concerned about the future of our city. And what's been really encouraging is that commitment to changing, transforming, working together with their neighbors to revitalize, rebuild, strengthen their neighborhoods. People across Chicago love the communities in which they live, and they're really willing to work hard to make them better. That's really encouraging. The other thing that I'll remember is visit this past week to a number of our elementary schools and high schools. We went to Shields Elementary School, and I met a number of the young people, and one young man gave me a book about the mayoral campaign in Chicago, filled with his own designs, his own artwork, and his own words, and that was very touching. And I also met with high school students who talked about their high schools and talked about the challenges those high schools faced, particularly around resources, the need for more counselors, the need for social workers and psychologists, for investment in our neighborhood public schools, and that touched me deeply.
All right, Ms. Breckwinkle. Ms. Lightfoot, we have to leave it there. We're at the end of our hour, believe it or not. Thank you. Good luck to both of you. I hope you enjoyed sharing time with us.
Thank you.
How about a big round of applause for our candidates from our audience?